This is Juhi Kwan. Today is July 29th, 2013, and I am here with Ms. Laura Jo Fu at her home in Oakland, California, for the Asian American Reproductive Justice Oral History Project. This is an effort to document the histories of Asian American women and their work, specifically in the field of reproductive justice. And I have a chance here today to interview Ms. Laura Jo Fu about her work in labor organizing, her involvement with NAPOV, and then her recent publications, Earth Passages, as well as her book on Asian American women. Perfect. Okay. Are those just your notes?
Right.
Okay. All right. So thank you so much for doing this. Your house is absolutely wonderful and lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to start by kind of going over the two topics that you specifically mentioned in your email. You said that you wanted to talk about the garment worker industry and then the 1980 hotel worker strike that you're doing oral history work on right now. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about why you chose those two specific topics for the project?
When we talk about Asian American feminism, the work of Asian American women, one of the areas that aren't covered is labor organizing, mm-hmm. union organizing. So I thought that that needs to be part of our history also. And there's plenty of women, I'm sure you can interview about NAPOV and and reproductive justice, but there's only a handful actually of Asian American women that where the history where labor history basically resides. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to talk about labor organizing and Asian American women, Asian immigrant women over the last 30 years or so.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you start your labor organizing work?
Well, how did I start? I myself was a garment worker at age 11. Mm-hmm. So I worked in the garment factory with my mother in San Francisco, Chinatown, mm-hmm. during my junior high school years. And watched as women who worked in sewing factories basically had to struggle to survive. You know, they worked the 6 or 7 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day at minimum wage, you know, mm-hmm. many of them. Even on those salaries, had to live in federal housing projects. Mm-hmm. The plight of garment workers really goes back to the early, you know, the 50s for Chinese immigrant garment workers, you know, mm-hmm. the 40s, the 50s. And so I grew up seeing this type of oppression in my own community. Child labor and desperate homework, and thought about it through all those years, including high school, college, mm-hmm. and remember thinking about what is the solution to this? You know, even as I was in high school, and in high school, one of the shops in Chinatown went on strike. It was one of the union shops. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've been through San Francisco Chinatown, you know, it's two main streets. There's Grant Avenue, mm-hmm. and then there's Stockton.
Yeah,
Grant Avenue is the tourist strip, and Stockton is basically the community center. And so there was a garment factory on Stockton Street, and one day, as I'm riding home on the bus from high school, I look out the window and there's this group of garment workers, you know, ages 40, 50, 60, and they're picketing, you know, they're picketing their shop, you know. Uh-huh. I could remember just the exhilaration, the feeling of finally immigrant workers are standing up for themselves, mm-hmm. you know, a group of Chinese immigrant workers are standing up for themselves, and that so for me unions became the solution, labor organizing became the solution, that nobody's going to give you your rights, you've got to take them for yourself. So that impression stayed, you know, stayed throughout my life, basically. So even as a labor attorney, I've always practiced law as an organizer. So I was an attorney organizer more than just an attorney. And you know, I went through a couple of transitions before I actually became a labor organizer. Including, you know, being a fashion designer, because having learned to sew at age 11, and having actually designed and produced custom clothing throughout junior high school and high school, and this is basic mainly for rich hippies, and then I went off to fashion design school. Yeah. That's where my art sort of took its, my artistic expression,
oh, wow.
took its direction. But I do remember that ending when one of my rich hippie customers said, you need to set up your own design house and your own manufacturing company. Mm-hmm. And so he sent me through this he sent me through this designer's shop. Mm-hmm. And the irony of it is, it's called the Margaret Rubel factory, or Margaret Rubel, whatever, which doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the irony of it was her shop that the women were picketing in Chinatown when I was 16.
No way, that's so funny.
It was really funny. And so now I'm age 18 or 19, I'm walking through her factory. And she's got a whole group of Chinese immigrant workers sewing away. Now, this was outside of Chinatown, so I have no idea what her wages and working conditions were, because they weren't in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. But what I realized at age 18, no, I think maybe I was age 19. At age 19, I realized that if I opened my own design house, I would have to hire workers. I would have to pay them minimum wage and overtime. I would not abuse them. And then I thought, you know, I'm a kid. This is too much. I'm not doing this. And so I decided to, I think I left for Alaska at that point. I just went to Alaska to work in the salmon canneries.
Oh, wow.
I've always, I mean, you asked earlier, why nature photography? If my earliest experiences out in nature, that basically was the place that I felt uncaged and the burdens of childhood lifting off of me. Because working in the garment factory at age 11 was because I had a father that abandoned us. Mm. You know, my mom had 6 kids, and she relied on her kids to work with her to put food on the table and rent and pay the rent and keep a roof over our heads. So as a kid, as a child, when I first experienced the woods and nature, it was the first place where I felt the claustrophobia lift, the burdens lift, you know, and that's been a lifelong love, nature. You know, so I would backpack whenever I could backpack. I photographed throughout the times that I backpacked. It wasn't until I was in my early 40s that my photography became art. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so back to your question about why labor organizing.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. So that's the roots of it. You know, it came from watching my mother wanting to improve the lives of Asian immigrant workers and their children, and understanding that. Nobody's going to do it for them, for us, unless women organized themselves. Mm-hmm. And I came back from Alaska, and San Francisco State University, back then, San Francisco State College, which is in 1971, was recruiting students in the communities into. Oh. For the purpose of eventually getting them into the four-year college. Uh-huh. So it was the extension program that came into the community and recruited. Uh-huh. And by then I was active in the Chinatown community, in youth work and artwork. So I got recruited into a one-year extension program. From there, we moved into four-year college. And so I think 1972, I started at San Francisco State University. Bypassed the SAT because we went through this extension program, and they were really implementing an affirmative action program to recruit people from the hood, to recruit minorities. And having come through the public school system in San Francisco, and my high school, where nobody went to four-year colleges, maybe a very small percentage of us, everybody went off to two-year colleges or went off to work. I had no idea what the SAT was anyway. So anyway, we bypassed the SAT and got into and got into college. And it was in and you probably remember the Third World Strike happened in 1968. You know, in the 70s, 71, 72, ethnic studies was just beginning. Asian American studies was just beginning.
And you were at the right place.
And I was
at FSU. Yeah,
exactly. I was at the right place. And so I got to help develop the courses, like the Asian, the Chinese American community course, the Cantonese language course, and in particular the Asian American women's course. It had been taught for one semester, I think, and I don't know if you know Pat Sumi. She's one of the early feminists from the early, from the 1970s. So she taught the first Asian American women's course at San Francisco State. And she was a Marxist, so she taught it from a Marxist perspective. And we were, there were no reading materials, first of all, right? There was just no reading material, period. And even Asian American literature at that point, or China, the only thing that was written probably was Jade Snow Wong's The Fifth Chinese Daughter, or something like that, and No No Boy, you know,
the Japanese,
the Japanese American. I think that was the only published work for us to read. Right? There was nothing else, and so instructors and students at that time were writing their own reading materials and their own lectures, and so as a Marxist, Pat was teaching feminism from race, class, and gender analysis, the intersection of race, class, and gender, before anybody else was doing it, basically. And around the same time, Bell Hooks was probably writing her feminist theory. So I remember delivering one of my first lectures on the triple oppression of Asian American women, right? So this is like 1972, 1973. And but it was that course that from that course I decided, what am I doing in college? I need to go back to organizing. Well, actually, I shouldn't say go back to organizing. I hadn't been organizing. I should go back into a garment factory and organize, and go back into a unionized garment factory. Because at that point, the union shops throughout San Francisco were decent, shops, paying living wages, 35-hour work weeks, not 40 hours, but they actually achieved a 35-hour work week with overtime pay and union protection from arbitrary firings and disciplines, etc. And then they had a third of the Chinatown shops unionized. Maybe not as many, as much as a third, but a significant number of the Chinatown shops unionized, but they were sweatshops. So they ignored the working conditions in the Chinatown shops. And the Chinatown shops that were unionized got health benefits, got pension, but the pension was so low that it didn't lift women out of poverty even after they retired. Mm-hmm. And my former mother-in-law actually worked in the union shop, which is how I discovered there were union shops in Chinatown. Right? And she continued working in a union shop to be able to get her health and welfare benefits, you know, her medical coverage and, and her union, and her pension. And I remember she worked her 10-hour days. She worked 6 days a week. She'd bring work home. She had an industrial sewing machine in her bedroom, and she'd be sewing, you know, after dinner. And this is supposed to be a union shop. So I decided, hang on a minute, I can turn off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.